Thank you all for coming on a Saturday morning when there are many other things you could be doing. Thank you, Nuno and Elizabeth, for organizing. Thank you, João, for accompanying me from Lisbon. So we sat here just for a few minutes in the same place as we were sitting before that. The same room, the same people, and yet the experience was very different. It was for me, in fact. And I'm assuming it was for you too, because we stopped what we had been doing before, which was talking, visiting, chattering, anticipating, wondering when is this starting, who will sit next to me, whatever was going on. We stopped, and suddenly, for myself, I was aware of many other things. I was aware of people talking upstairs, I was aware of a dog barking, I was aware of the floor, which I hadn't paid any attention to. I was aware of a chair cracked occasionally, which I didn't hear when we were all talking. I was aware that I was thirsty. Many things became more present because I had stopped. We had all stopped chattering and doing what we were doing before. And this is not a judgment. This is just an observation. It was absolutely fine what was happening before. And it was absolutely fine what was happening when we were sitting. But it is a direct experience of what our Zen practice is about. And I don't know how many people in this room actually have a Zen practice or sit on a cushion or are involved in some kind of meditation. But if you are, you recognize the experience that you just had and what I've just described of other things we become aware of when we stop being scattered and involved in our activities and our chatter. And this is actually a very profound experience, what we just had. We don't think of it as being profound, or we might sometimes. But it's the depth of it is that it is it's actually beyond space and time, that experience that we have there, because it's not dependent on these usual forms and the movement of our daily lives. When we sit, we're not involved in the movement of our daily lives. We're involved in another aspect of our being, which is stillness, not old, not young, not fast, not short, not tall, not slow. Although we may, after a few minutes, think, well, when is she going to stop this? I didn't come here for this, or this isn't comfortable where I'm sitting, or I'm tired and I'm falling asleep. Many things we might bring us back to our very human experience of time and space and everything that goes with that. And our own idea about ourself and our body and the others and this room, our opinions, what we would like to be doing instead, what we will have for lunch, previous experiences, sitting, whatever. But there is a moment often when we just stop and sit when it's not that. And then very quickly we will grab that and say, oh, that was nice. That was nice. I'd like to repeat that. Well, then we've already gone off into the world of getting, spending, having, not having, whatever. Um, So I like to introduce with an experience like that, so we kind of all can share what we might be talking about as we go on. We can be familiar with the topic in a very concrete, experiential way. In a traditional setting, at a Zen retreat, we would have a sitting period, more lengthy, before there would be this talk. So we're in a framework that provides us with a more different kind of presence when we hear someone speak about the Dharma like this. And before everyone had arrived, and there were a few of us standing around chatting, and there was a discussion about the borders of Portugal and Spain and traditions that exist on both sides of the border. I'm talking like in the east. Even the language that people speak on either side of the border, the Portuguese speak with a Spanish kind of accent, and the Spaniards probably speak with some kind of Portuguese accent. And we usually focus so much on borders and separations and fail to realize that they are just human creations. And when we have a situation like that where we see that, oh, the traditions are the same, I was talking about in February for Carnival, how the costumes and the practices are the same on both sides of the border. Also, someone, Nuno, mentioned that in a study it had been proven that the Portuguese genetically have more relation with North Africa than with the rest of Europe. We see how really these borders and the ideas about people and who they are and what they do are just creations of our mind, actually. Right? Very useful sometimes, you know. For directions, for how to get somewhere. You know, it's helpful to have a GPS to find your way around, and helpful that the streets have names and that there are streets and that there are trains and they tell you what the stations are and a timetable that tells you when you will arrive so that we can organize our human activities, right? And hopefully, I mean, the idea is that, let's say, hopefully is not necessarily a good word, but the way we can most effectively live together is to form create these divisions and separations, not to separate and divide, but to function with better harmony together, right? We know that that's not what happens, right? We see that this is not how the world functions. And that's where we come to the title of this talk, which I have to give a title. I don't usually like to give titles, but I decided that I would give a title that relates to what is on our minds a lot today. We think of these as being dark times because there is so much violence, so much conflict, such fixed positions about issues, about the other, whether it's to do with the COVID pandemic, whether it's to do with Israel and Hamas, whether it's to do with Ukraine and Russia, whether it's to do with, I was talking with Elizabeth about the elections in the Netherlands. We're really involved in all of these separations and differences, and a lot of conflict arises from that. We have the same things that happen within ourselves, right? We have parts of ourselves we don't like. We have parts of ourselves we like. We have a fixed idea about who we are and who we should be, who we want people to see, what we don't want people to see. And we protect ourselves because we don't want others to hurt us. We hurt others because we don't want them, they're different than us, or we think they're hurting us, so we hurt them. We know how this goes, right? And this is not even to mention the climate crisis, right? We could go on all day talking about the crises that our world that we're facing today. And the climate crisis, too, arises from the same sense of not seeing the oneness. We don't see that everything is interconnected. We don't see the consequences of our actions. We do now, more clearly, but we have a hard time admitting it, and we have an even harder time changing our patterns and our practices that create those problems, right? So when we say the Zen and the art of life in dark times, we could also say Zen and the art of life in light times, because it's not different whether we're living in dark times or light times. Because light and dark when I woke up this morning, it was dark. Right? And, well, I woke up very early because I had to get a train to come here from Lisbon, but it was dark, and by the time I left my apartment, it was light. I didn't see that happening, right? I couldn't see where it says on my phone, sunrise at 7:05 or something. I don't know, but I didn't see that happen. I can't tell you where when it went from light to dark. Or yesterday afternoon, every afternoon I go for a long, long walk, and when I left, it was, you know, bright afternoon, sunny, beautiful Lisbon. Walking up and down the hills, all around, sun reflecting on the river, everything. When I got home, it was dark. But I don't know when it became dark. I can't tell you when that happened. Maybe Nuno could tell us more about this, but we won't go there, because that's not really the point. The point is that there are these differences, and yet when we really try to see where the line is, there isn't one, which tells us that there really isn't a difference. Of course, it helps us to recognize, and it's important to recognize light and dark, day and night. It's very important. It's important to recognize child, adult, to recognize shoe sizes, clothing sizes, speed limits, all kinds of things, right? Very useful when they bring us to live harmoniously. But when we concentrate and focus on them in a hurtful, unwholesome way, then we have all kinds of trouble. And the reason we focus, we have an unwholesome activity around them, is because we're fixed on them. So anytime we hold to the differences rather than just acknowledge them and not see them as other, but just a different manifestation. So the daylight is just a different manifestation than the what I call the day, but night is just a different manifestation, a different moment in this experience of life, right? Now, in the Zen tradition that I practice in Wildflower, the group that is here as well, we practice in, is we are descended from two branches of the Zen schools, one which is called the Soto school, which is just sitting. There are and depending on which teacher or which master, you know, the posture is the point. For others, the kesa, the robe, is the point. Others, the ritual is the point. All of them are just pointing to the same awakening to the wholeness of life, just different ways of doing it. The other branch, which my lineage also holds, is the same point of awakening to the wholeness of life, to the oneness, the non-duality, and yet has a very different approach. We use a tool that we call koans, which are these supposedly mysterious enigmas, stories, phrases, poems that make no sense to our conceptual thinking mind. And therefore, our conceptual thinking mind thinks of it as nonsense, a riddle, something mysterious, and often we'll say, well, there's no point, I give up, I don't want to know, it doesn't make sense, whatever. An example, the famous one that we often hear about, is the sound of one hand clapping. It makes no sense, one hand clapping, right? And it doesn't. Makes absolutely no sense. And but we're not looking for the sense. The whole practice is to help us to let go of our fixed ideas, our positions, everything that we've that I've mentioned until now, to let go of ways that we usually look at a situation, a person, a thing, ourselves, to let go of those ideas. Our mind becomes exhausted with a koan. All of the beliefs and positions we have that we're hanging on so tightly to are exhausted. And therefore, we have the possibility of opening to some other experience. Like we did today. So we stopped our chattering. We stopped our usual functioning of, like, talking to the person next to us, looking around at the other people, maybe noticing how they're dressed or noticing what the room looks like, all of this, and having opinions about it. And we stopped all that and just sat here. That's a big koan to just sit here. It's like, well, what is this? What is it right now? The royal one is, who is it, right? So who is sitting here right now? What is here? What is here? What does that mean? When I'm out there, I'm here. So I go to the toilet. When I'm in the toilet, I'm here. When I'm in the toilet is being in the toilet, right? But when I'm here, it's here. So there is no here and there, actually. It's just a matter of experience, okay? Koans help us to awaken, to open to these possibilities, experiencing things differently, right? And there's a koan that appears in various collections. We have many, many collections. These are, you know, treasures of Chinese and Japanese literature, these koan collections. Not only are they koan, used for koan practice in a very serious way, but they also are considered masterpieces of literature. So there's one that appears in several of them, and I don't have the exact wording, but it's translated in many different ways, but so I will just give you a kind of improvised version of it. There was a teacher whose name was Dai Zui, and this was in China, in the golden age of Zen, the Tang Dynasty, which was the 9th century, 8th and 9th century in China. A student asked, so a monk, of course, if this was a monastic practice, asks Dai Zui, when the great Kalpa fire, you know, the apocalyptic fire of the greatest of all fires, burns all of the universes, not just this universe we think of, but all of the universes, and they all perish, will it perish? Sometimes it says, will this perish? Sometimes it's, will it perish? Will that perish? Will that perish too? Okay? So we'll come back to this. And Dai Zui says, it will perish. And this monk then says, if so, following the universe, will the other perish too? And he says, it will perish. Okay? Okay, so it sounds very weird. Okay, this is strange what I just said. It makes no sense that this is a koan, right? So it makes no sense. But so I bring it up here because, you know, we feel like we're facing a really apocalyptic time, right? The end of our species, possibly. The end of civilization as we know it. Constant conflict. The whole situation with the Palestinians and the Israelis and Hamas. And all, it seems just hopeless. There seems no way out. And it seems like it's only getting worse. Although we are today on the second day of a truce, right? So it's like, okay. So maybe something else can happen, right? So we do have moments of light in this. And yet the whole situation seems just hopeless all over, right? Everywhere we turn. You know, the economy is terrible, people are starving, homeless people, refugees, just you name it, right? There's problems everywhere. So in a sense, you know, the monk is asking, okay, if all of this disappears, if it all explodes, you know, we could, in any moment, you know, we've created, by separation, I might note, creation of the atomic bomb results in splitting the atom, right? Something like that. Okay. Mm-hmm. So, comes from split, from separation, division. This most horrific weapon, right? That we can destroy our... We're the only species that destroys its own habitat. You know, the other species are probably looking at us thinking... What's wrong with them? Why are they destroying their habitat? Usually we protect our home and we, you know, we function as one with our habitat. That's why it's our habitat, because it works for us, you know. So we've created this amazing capacity, whether it be by splitting the atom or whether it be by, you know, driving cars all the time or polluting the water, whatever. You know, all of our behavior splits and creates... is destructive. So we're like the monk facing this absolute destruction of everything, right? Maybe not in our lifetime. Probably not in our lifetime, although if the atomic bomb any moment could be in our lifetime. But then what is our lifetime? So immediately we say, oh, it's not my lifetime. I'm not going to be here. Okay, so that already... is a huge separation we're creating. So people have children. People have grandchildren. Maybe people have grandchildren who have grandchildren. I don't know, in this room probably not, but... where do we draw the line between my lifetime? Is my lifetime the moment when I take my last breath? Yes, from the human experience, yes, of course, this body is limited. And will, at some point, there will be a final breath, and this body will die, as we say, right? And essentially, it returns, all of the makes up this body returns to the earth, and as Thich Nhat Hanh famously says, you know, when I look at a piece of paper, I see the cloud. Because the cloud... brought rain, which brought tree, which brought paper. I mean, and he's like reducing it to simplifying it. But where do we draw the line? Okay, so my lifetime. I know, okay, my last breath, and then so I won't be here to experience the end of civilization, terminology you want to use. And yet, if we don't think of it as my lifetime only, if we think of it in terms of the nature of existence, the nature of being, everything is one, And so, as like the Buddha famously said on his awakening, me and everybody else throughout space and time, everybody, everything else throughout space and time, are awakened at once. So it's all simultaneous. Maybe Nuno can tell me something about this. Someone recently told me, a physicist, that if we could travel at the speed of light, which we could never do, everything, every moment would be here right now. Something like that?
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is really, that is the experience of when we say awakening. It's all one. And so it takes, and it's interesting that scientists arrive at the same conclusion through all kinds of, you know, calculations and experiences, experiments, but it comes to the same place. Maybe they don't interpret it in the same way, that experience, and they say, if we could do this, this is what we would experience. And what I say is that is what I experience when I sit there and have this experience of everything's one, right? And that changes everything then, right? If we see that I and the other are not separate, meaning, of course, we are different manifestations of the same thing, let's say, okay? So, you know, maybe look at your children. For those of you who have children, or brothers and sisters, your family unit, right? You clearly, you know, your brother is not you, or your child is not you, and yet you have this familiarity, and sometimes it's hostile, right? You don't even speak to your brother anymore, or children and parents fight or something. But there is this, we know that we are one, different manifestations of the same family, let's say. Whether it's brothers, sisters, parents, children, cousins even, we will extend it. Ancestors, so Mark's telling me the story of his family who came from Alsace, and then, you know, some of them went to Paris, and then some guy came to the U.S., and yet they're all, they're all from the same family. They're all from the same guy, you know, who changed his name, and so you can identify it. And yet, if we really extended that, like I once afternoon in a retreat in Paris, when I was really bored, and I thought, how am I going to make it through these 2 hours of meditation? I started kind of what Mark was telling me this morning. I started thinking, okay, so how is it that I am sitting here in this meditation place in a suburb of Paris when I come from, like, the upper Midwest in America? How did this happen? And I went through this whole thing of chasing the train of how I got there. And when I got to Napoleon, I stopped. I think probably the last bell rang or something. But also, it became so clear to me that, well, it was endless. My ancestors who came from, you know, in America, it's a fascination. It's ancestry, right? Less so probably for Europeans because they didn't move around so much. Although now it's becoming really, you know, are you really French or did you come from somewhere else, you know, before you became French? Even if it was several generations ago, you're not really French then. And probably the same kind of stuff here, I don't know. Yet, we're all one. I mean, if we traced it back as far as we could possibly go, if we went as far as the physicists have gone, we would see that it's all one. And all of these, when we see these little, you know, say foibles of human folly, it's tragic, you know? When I visited Jerusalem on a peacemaking mission, interfaith peacemaking thing with Zen master Bernie Glassman, this was so this was 23 years ago. And there was a little lull in the fighting at that time. It was between the intifadas or something. I don't remember what it was. But we went on a tour. I chose to go on a tour around Old Jerusalem and up onto the Mount of Olives, which is just... If anyone's been to Jerusalem, it's not really this mountain or anything. It's East Jerusalem, which at the time, I don't know if it still is, because there's settlers now, but it was Palestinian territory. And go up there, and the guide said yes, and he was telling us about Jesus, and he said, yeah, Jesus stood up here and looked down on Jerusalem, teeming Jerusalem, you know, and all the human follies, and wept. And said, poor Jerusalem, poor Jerusalem. We could say the same thing today, but we could say the same thing about each one of us and each of our places we go that are full of conflict and struggle. And the reason that they're full of conflict and struggle is because we don't see who we truly are, and we don't see the true nature. We don't see the oneness. We don't see the unity of all beings and things. So when the monk asks Daizui this, you know, he's saying, so if all the universes are perishing, and if they all go up in the apocalyptic nuclear bomb or something, he says this, but you can hear there's a sense of I. Right? So, will I too perish? Sometimes it's translated as the self. Will the self perish? Right? And Daizui responds, it will perish. It will perish. Then he asks, well, something about the other, I forget how that's translated. Will that perish? He said, yes, following along the other, it will perish. There's another part of the koan where the monk goes and asks another teacher because he wants to hear something better. Probably, you know? He doesn't like this idea that he's going to perish, right? So he goes and the other teacher says, it will not perish. It's like, oh my God, this is becoming a bigger koan then. One guy says it will perish and the other guy says it won't perish. Actually, they're saying the same thing. One of the things that koans open us up to is what we could call the other-making mind, or the mind of other-making. It just creates other all the time. It creates me and you. It creates Moroccan and Portuguese. It creates Palestinian and Israeli. You know, something that was surprising for me in Israel was... I grew up in America in a big Jewish community, but they were not, they were Ashkenazi Jews, so they were European Jews. When I went to Israel, the Palestinians and the Jews, it was hard to know the difference, who was who, except by the way they dressed, and the parts of the city they lived in. Otherwise, they were completely, they looked like brothers, you know, everybody looked the same. And we don't even have to look the same to be the same, right? So we can say, okay, well, then I'm not like the Koreans because I don't look like them. Or, you know, I'm not like the guys from Senegal because I don't look like them. And they're a man and I'm a woman, you know, something like that. But actually, we make the other into other with our conceptual mind. Before the Africans were brought as slaves to America, the notion of black and white did not exist. The Africans didn't think of themselves as having black skin, and the white people didn't think of themselves as having white skin, right? But then they make the other. It's different than me, so it's other. And other is usually, we don't want it. We feel threatened. Our very existence feels threatened by the other because we don't know who this is. We don't know that we are already that. My Dharma name that my teacher gave me, is, in French, tu es cela, which is, you are that. So, you are that, I am that, I am that, I am that, I am that, you are that. Not for our conceptual mind. For our intellectual thinking mind, no, that's not it. I'm not a flower. I'm not a North African. I'm not a man. It's interesting now, you know, with our gender issues today, the subject of, you know, non-binary, identifying as a gender or not. Very interesting subject, you know. Because, of course, yes, you know, we look like we have biological functions, physical characteristics that we identify as female or male, right? And that's absolutely essential to the recreation of our species, right? And very different ways of functioning, being, and yet we have this whole fluidity today where it doesn't have to be fixed. That's a whole another subject, but it's an example of things not being fixed, let's say, okay? It's interesting that when we venture into that sphere of things not being fixed, it creates a whole lot of conflict because people don't want that. Or people are for it or against it. You know, we don't want to give health care to trans people or whatever. You know, or we don't want a gay person to be teaching our children or whatever. You know, all the positions we have of fixed ideas about the other. So basically, you know, I'm not going to go into the depths of this koan because it can actually only be experienced. You know, it doesn't mean that because we're talking about it today and you hear what I'm saying and understand what I'm saying that you have passed the koan, because what's important is to have the experience of it. But what I can say about the koan is that when we say all the universe perishes and will the other perish as well, whatever, and we say if the other perishes, you perish, because it's the truth. If there is no other, then there is no you. And because you are one with the universe, if the universe perishes, you perish as well. But what perishes is the concept of it. Because the nature of it, very clearly they translate it as it or this or that, the nature of that does not perish. So when he says it does not perish, it does not perish. So like I said, our lifetime will end and our physical body will end, but the nature of being persists, is unchanging, manifests in all many different possible ways. It could manifest as the end of civilization. That's just another manifestation of it. So why am I talking about all this in our dark times, and the art of living in these dark times? So another way of seeing, you know, we talk about these dualities of samsara and nirvana, for example, and they actually are not, it's not like, oh, this situation is samsara and that situation is nirvana. It's a way of experience, and I'm using these terms, maybe you don't know what they mean, so I'm explaining them, but samsara is a way of experiencing whatever is here and now. It's a way of experiencing it in struggling because it's not good enough, we don't want it to change, we want to kill the people who don't look like us, we're uncomfortable, we don't want to die, we're sick, and we struggle with this, and we are upset and angry and sad and fearful, and defensive and aggressive and violent and all these things. And the behavior that arises from that perpetuates it. So it's this endless cycle of experiencing things in this samsaric way. We say that our practice is about putting an end to that. This is what the Buddha said. He said it's possible to put an end to that. And it doesn't mean that the circumstances change. It's like when we sat here on our chairs. When we were chattering away and looking around and daydreaming, nothing changed here. The only thing that changed was the way that we chose to experience it. We chose to stop all of that and sit here, which is a way of connecting in awakening to the oneness, a way of connecting with the oneness instead of the differences. And so we say nirvana is when we put an end to that. It's the end of all of that samsaric cycle. And it's the end of the struggle because we've stopped. And we've, instead of focusing on the separations and the differences and what we want and what don't want, we awaken to the oneness, the non-duality, the non-separation. It doesn't mean that there aren't two chairs. It's like the famous Confucius saying that I quote all the time, so I'm sorry if those of you who know me, you've heard this, but he said we have two lives. The second one begins when we see we only have one. Mm-hmm. So, okay, there's two chairs, but actually there isn't. One chair that's manifesting as two, so that two people can sit there who aren't two people, but they're manifesting as two people. So how does that apply to our world today? It just seems beyond our capacities to have any difference, right, in the world. To have some action that could bring peace, could bring love, could bring the end to our climate disaster. It just seems impossible. And it is for any one of us to stop any of this, right? However, what we're doing this morning makes a difference. It makes a difference in your life. And then in your life, when you go out, your experience today, when you go out, maybe you'll be attentive, maybe not, it doesn't really matter, but you bring what you experienced here today into the lives of the world, whether it was plants and animals or people or family or the lady selling you bread or the guy on the train, whatever. It makes a difference. Every breath makes a difference. It makes all the difference for your body, every breath you take. And depending on the air that you breathe, it will also make a difference. You know, if you live in a place that's very polluted, like I do in Paris, probably, you know, my body is not... It's not the best thing for my body to live in Paris, right? At least from that point of view. If you live someplace where they use a lot of pesticides on the plants, glyphosate, I don't know how you say that in English or Portuguese, whatever. You know, that's not very healthy. I'm convinced my mother had lung cancer. She survived, but never smoked in her life, although my father smoked. But the doctor said, nope, this is not from passive smoke, this kind of lung cancer you had. He said, it's environmental. Very mysteriously, it's environmental. I'm convinced that she, when I helped her clean out her garage, she had this stuff Roundup in her garage, which is glyphosate, is that how it is? Yeah. And she lives in this gated community where they have these beautiful gardens and lawns and things. Where I'm sure they just put that shit on there all the time, you know, to kill the weeds, right? I'm convinced that's what it came from, right? So it does affect, every breath we take has an effect on our body. You know, it makes a difference whether we think it's good or bad, you know. Every action, every movement, every thought even has an effect. We take vows to that in our Zen tradition, you know, based upon body, speech, and thought, because thought too has an effect. And we see, because thought is very divisive. Thought can be, can we use it? Like Matthieu Ricard always says, you know, we can do these amazing things with science. You know, we can cure all kinds of diseases. We can create a nuclear bomb. We can, you know, build these, you know, amazing airplanes and structures that won't collapse in earthquakes and, you know, all kinds of things we can do with science. The human mind is capable of also raising the body-mind, as we say, raising the mind of awakening. It's the same mind. The same mind that destroys is the same mind that can wake up and make a difference. In each moment of your life, it's possible. I talked about this last week at our day of practice. The French Jesuit philosopher Pierre Teilhard de Chardin has this great observation, which for me is very telling in this, around this subject. He says, we are not human beings having a spiritual experience. We are spiritual beings having a human experience. And that changes everything. So we're usually thinking it's like this, right? That we're these human beings having a spiritual experience sometimes. If we're lucky, we have the spiritual experience. Or, oh, that feels very spiritual. But actually, it's like this. You know, we are spiritual beings. That's who we truly are. And we're having this human experience. And samsara and nirvana belong to the human experience. All of this dark stuff belongs to the human experience. Can this change like the paradigm of how we see ourselves? Because it does, it really opens the space. We say, oh, okay. So actually I'm this spiritual being and I don't have to be identified with all of this human experience stuff. Usually we think it's that I have to try to become this spiritual being. I have to try to have this spiritual experience. But it's actually there all the time. We're so caught up in the spiritual being is that's who we are. It's always there. That's what does not die. That's what is not born. That's what is out of time and space. That's what could travel at the space of time, at the speed of light. That's it right there. The spiritual being is beyond space and time. So it has no problem with everything being here and now. Everything, Everywhere, All at Once, right? The film, you know. Very intriguing title. That's why I went to, well, I saw it on an airplane, but I thought, wow, this is really good. So, how was it translated in Portuguese? The title of that movie, does anyone know? The same?
Yeah, it's the same.
And yet, we're really deeply entrenched in this human experience. All this stuff that doesn't work. You know, the door doesn't open on the train, or the it's not the right kind of coffee, or they won't take your bank card, or, you know, all this stuff that just, you know, drives us crazy, right? And that's, we're not even going into climate change and war and Gaza being completely destroyed and, you know, the poor Ukrainians living under war for months and years. Just that everyday stuff of the human experience. If we can see, if we can connect with the spiritual being, that changes how we experience that daily stuff. It changes how we, you know, maybe we can say, I wouldn't say it makes it lighter necessarily, but it removes the suffering involved with it. So we maybe don't like it, you know, I'm annoyed that they won't take my bank card, but okay, you know, I'll pay with cash or whatever it is. The door doesn't open, okay, I'll go to another door. Or they don't have that kind of coffee, okay, well, I don't even drink coffee, so I don't know, but okay, they don't have, you know, at Starbucks, they don't have the one you want, so you get another one, or whatever. Or Starbucks is closed, so I go to the cafe and sit down, you know. Because we say pain is unavoidable, suffering is optional. We have the choice, you know. We have the choice of indulging in this human experience and not looking to the oneness and therefore continuing the samsaric cycle. Or we have the choice of, okay, I'm going to look into this and see what she's talking about. So again, don't believe me. Don't take my word for it. I'm just introducing this possibility that might inspire you to look differently, think differently, sit down, remember the experience you had here. It's really good to have an experience that you had that you can refer to, because reference points can be really difficult and harmful. They can also be helpful. Coming and spending, I've been in Lisbon now for 2 weeks, and the first few days were absolutely amazing because I had no reference points. It was absolutely beautiful experience. Whether it was not knowing the city and the language or not having any reference points in my daily life because I'm not doing what I usually do. And absolutely amazing. Very liberating. Now I already have more reference points, and yet still, it's still fresh. You know, different to talk to this group than to talk to my students who I talk to all the time. Yet, I do have reference points. And I have reference points, you know, I have my feet and my butt and I sit here, you know, so I do have reference points. So they can be helpful. And yet, if we hang on to them, they cause trouble. Or we will experience things in a troubling way, right? It'll trouble us and trouble others. So there is no secret. You know, the secret is that there's no secret, I guess. It's just you know, as the great Ram Dass used to say, it's just be here now. And as the great Bernie Glassman used to say, is don't be here now. So it's like, you know, perishes and doesn't perish. So it's both, right? So I'm just going to glance here and see if there was anything. I made some notes of what I wanted to be sure to touch upon, but I think I've done it more or less. So I don't know how much time we have, but I would like to open it to questions or comments. I always like to hear what people have to say. Or be able to address questions if you have them. Whether it's about this, or whether it's about the practice we have here, or whatever. Yes?
I was Just a curiosity of mine, please, because I come from a Soto practice, and just we don't do koans. And please, just for me to try to understand better how koans can be integrated in our daily practice. So if you sit, each one of us sit, and can be brought up to the here and now, and if we can, in our daily practice, be more aware of this being here and now, how can koans help us? Mm-hmm. You know, it's just a curiosity of mine because I really have a different experience.
Yeah, good question. I think that, well, for one thing, you know, a traditional koan practice is done with a teacher. You know, you have to see a teacher to do it. But just more globally or generally, I could say that it's more a way of being curious or inquisitive. I don't know if you understand that word, inquisitive. Inquiring. So, what, like I said, who am I? Or what is this? Or what is my life? You know, our life is actually everybody's biggest koan is our life. And so in a regular sitting practice, that's how it works, kind of. It allows us to open to the moment by not focusing on one aspect of it, or we might have a usual, you know, I don't know, in your practice, if you work with the breath or posture, what do you do really? Regularly.
In daily life and a non-monastic life, we do the zazen daily if you're ordained mainly, and then you have your day-to-day life. But as the years go by, probably you experience also these changes between one thing and another become lighter.
Absolutely.
And that's why I'm asking, how can this be of help? Because it becomes easier for you to become concentrated in your day-to-day tasks. This always helps, also helps you from having the wandering mind.
Yeah, so you know, this is very interesting that you bring it up, because this is touching to the heart of the differences between the two approaches, which come to the same place. And it's actually very beautiful. That, so, like, we give the example, especially in a practice like what you describe, where, but the same thing applies with koan, with the Rinzai practice. We say it's like walking through a field at dawn, a grassy field, and once, when you've crossed the field, you realize that your shoes and your trousers are wet. They become wet just by walking. You didn't walk through that field in order to get wet. And you didn't notice you were getting wet. But that's what happens in our practice. So like you say, yeah, something happens. And maybe the separation between daily life and your zazen practice, or it's more easy to be concentrated in your activities or something. It just happens.
In practice, during a meditation, how do we come to these koans? So the master gives you an idea or a koan or whatever for you to talk during the meditation phase, or how comes the koan to the... Okay, always transmitted to koan from the master to... the master to the...
Yeah, it is. The master gives you the koan.
In the beginning of the meditation phase?
Well, usually you're working with the teacher, and so in a dokusan, the teacher will say, okay, take this koan.
Okay.
And then you work on it, and you come and then come back to dokusan. Dokusan is a meeting with the teacher.
Okay.
And you come back.
One by one.
Absolutely, yeah. One by one. And you, so when you are sitting on your cushion during your zazen, you bring this question up, and then it drifts away. Bring it up again, it drifts away. You maybe then concentrate on your breath for a while. Question comes back. You try to become one with the question so that you don't even have to consciously think about it, remember the story. It's not usually a story that long, especially in the beginning of practice. It's usually just, even in the beginning, it's even just one word, mu. So we bring it up, and then when we come back to see the teacher, again, the master, we share with them what our experience, we present our experience of it. And the master will probe, will ask questions about it, or say no, ring the bell, and you go away. And then you come back again. No, you go away. No. You go away. But the whole point is to take away that mind that separates the mind of other-making, the mind of duality, so that we can experience some aspect of oneness. And I'm, you know, I think that it really is fascinating that it's just a different technique. It's not. We're going the same place. Yeah.
Being in silence is the better way to be here and now, and to focus our mind in that concept of only one and not separate.
Well, I don't. I hesitate to use a word like better, but it. It is more favorable, let's say, because we have fewer distractions. Our mind is so full of distractions that when we sit here, even for those 5 minutes we sat, you know, I'm sure your mind was going all over, and mine too. So when we make it silent, as silent as what we think of as silence, stillness, so we don't move, a ritual of some kind, you know. So I said, I'll tap my glasses on the glass, and that means we'll stop. So there was a little ritual that helps us. Then there's a lot of things we don't have to think about anymore, and yet we keep thinking. So that's why it's helpful. I wouldn't say it's better, because we can have, you know, one of the masters in our lineage, Peter Matheson, had life-changing awakening experience on a troop ship in the South Pacific during the Second World War, which I'm assuming was not a silent, comfortable place to, you know. Mm-hmm. It's possible at any moment, but for us ordinary people, it's easier, maybe not better, but easier. Yeah?
Hello. I don't practice like many people maybe, but I feel like you are saying I walk on the grass and I get wet, I go to the mountain and I see beautiful flowers, examples of being with the nature and experience my soul in the nature. It's what I do. And the question is about this struggling in this nirvana. We have both, and we have to balance a little bit, maybe, because we need to be aware of the problems and then try to solve them. It's a question.
Well, so just the first aspect. So when I describe walking around Lisbon, and I start out in the day, and when I come home, it's night. It's the equivalent of walking through the field and finding that I'm wet. It doesn't have to be in nature. Mm-hmm. So it can be anywhere. Let's say that the problems are problems in this because we're looking for a solution, right? And from in the human experience realm, And we can experience, like I said, samsara and nirvana. The problem is not nirvana, samsara, and the solution nirvana. Okay, we can experience the problem as samsara from a samsaric way. We can also experience it from a nirvana, in a nirvana way. Okay, so those are ways of experiencing it, mm-hmm. because that's how we are. Whether we see it from this way, this position of separation and difference, or whether we see it from a position, which is not a position of oneness, neither one are actually positions, but we have to use words. We even say that samsara and nirvana are one. Samsara is nirvana, and nirvana is samsara. But that is from the nirvana point of view. I know this is sounding really confusing. Just that to say that, yes, we do need to look for solutions to the problems. This is not... It's often really misinterpreted that Zen is about passivity, not doing anything, everything is good. That's not true. And we have a better chance of looking at ways to put an end to our difficulties if we can connect with the spiritual being and the nirvana experience or something like that.
Yeah. Returning to the point of the online question, for us is very interesting because we are so long, so distant, and the distance is very... But in fact, Soto practitioners, Soto students, all of us, we have plenty of comments in our practice. Not the formal one, but like yours, like this is the teacher. But when the teacher gives you a name, this is a koan also.
Absolutely, big one, yeah.
And the koan of life, what is it? It's a big koan. And always we return to that koan. This is not a koan, of course, but we follow with it. We did. And our practice itself, if we are in the kitchen, if we are in the sleeping, if we are in the toilets, if we are in the dojo, if you are doing zazen, all of this is a koan to this is you understand this, of course.
Absolutely.
And you practice this, of course.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think maybe what we could say to maybe clarify it for everybody is that, so when we talk about koan practice in our lineage, it's just that it's been made a curriculum and a systematic way of working with the teacher individually, which is different than like what you're describing. And yet, like I said, it will bring us to the same place in just a different way. And in your tradition as well, I mean, because we do have a strong Soto component in our lineage, because the transmission, actually, the shiho, as we say, from teacher to student, is a Soto transmission. In the Rinzai tradition, they don't have that. So our transmission is from Dogen, like you, and so forth. We're going the same place. We're doing the same thing, actually. Just manifesting in a different way.
Yeah. Always we come to that little koan about the bondo, the talk between the master and the student, and of course you know it. The student asks a special question to the master: what is the meaning of life, or something else. And have you drink your tea? Yes. Oh, so clean it and go on. Not to talk of the extraterrestrial things like the meaning of life or everything else. But to practice, to be here, to continue.
Mm-hmm.
Normally we are. The suggestion is not to think too much, of course. We always have the idea that the koan is singing, but of course not.
It's not.
Of course.
No, that's right.
Yes.
It's not.
It's practice with it.
Yeah, exactly. And in some, you know, I know, for example, some teachers I know from San Francisco in the Suzuki lineage, they have koan classes and they study the koans, you know, as literature and as a spiritual practice, but it's a study that is not based around experiential exchange transmission with the teacher. It doesn't mean that it's not good, it's just a different approach to it. And in the one you cite, there are different versions of that. It's Joshu when the student arrives in a monastery and he says, okay, can you teach me, master? And Joshu says, have you had your breakfast? And the student says, yes, I have. And he says, well, then wash your bowls. And often we think of this as being, like you say, just, okay, fine, you had your breakfast, then we'll do daily life, do what you need to do in the daily life, you know. At the same time, can we see there's something else going on there? Because if it was just that, it would not have been transmitted teacher to disciple and, you know, gathered in these great collections and persisted for how many centuries? That was in the 9th century in China. There's something else going on there. And yet, that what you say is exactly, that's it too, you know. But there's also something else going on there. And so when we're talking about an experiential, an experience of the koan, that's something else we're talking about.
But the point is, in the koan, there's intention to pass a message or just to practice and try to better yourself or whatever. There's no message to...
No. There's no message, there's no intention to better yourself, no, no. Of course, as we say, you know, that the goal is to have no goal, and yet we do. We have this aspiration to wake up, to experience the wholeness, the oneness, the non-duality of life. Everything I've just sat here talked about for I don't know how long, you know. So you're intrigued. You're like, yeah, I would like to experience that. So there is that. But with koans, we come up constantly against this, you know, the equivalent of Bodhidharma's wall where he sat for 9 years. Mm-hmm. We constantly come against this wall where it's not it, it's not it, it's not it. Until it is. But it's not what we think it is.
Mm-hmm. I was thinking about it. Maybe it isn't even so much the message for the koan, because for me, the book, the koans are a book. And every time I open, I see the new koan, I think, oh man, I'm never going to get this. This is ridiculous. I'm going to be in this koan for the rest of my life. Or, wow, I'm going to use this. I'm going to win there. I'm not at the bell. It's going to be great. That's none of those things are ever true, you know? And that, one of my problems and experiences in life, the way my life is difficult for me, is I think, because I'm a social worker, oh, I see this person's problem. I can fix it. Or I have an idea, I'm going to fix it, I'm going to solve it, or I can't fix it, it's not. And, but koan practice, you know, 350 koans later, you say, whatever you think is wrong, if you think you can't do it, you're going to be able to, and if you think you can, you're probably going to really struggle over it. I think just the whole work of working with koans has informed my outside life that way, that I look at how I act, just approaching a new idea and how I think I can conquer it or I can solve it, fix it. It makes me question how I, that way. That's what I've gotten out of it. Yeah.
Well, yeah, thank you. And that so that brings us to, you know, the subject today. Okay, so the whole situation we find ourselves in the world is a big koan. Mm-hmm. Right? Nobody understands it. And we have a lot of ideas about it. You know, I can fix it, or I can't fix it, or, you know, lots of ideas, different positions, and yet it's a koan, big koan. What is this? And I, just a little anecdote, when, in 2016, when it was the height of the refugee crisis in France, all of these people coming from Afghanistan, Syria, a lot from Syria, all over the place, these refugees. And it made no sense to me. It was a real koan to me. How can this be that all of these people are forced to leave their homes, their livelihoods, their families on these really treacherous journeys, dying, exploited, persecuted, all of this. They arrive in a place where they're seeking sanctuary, where they're seeking to be safe and received, and we tell them, no, you can't come here. I couldn't figure it out. It made no sense to me. Of course, I knew the geopolitical explanations for it. And, you know, again, like with going back to Napoleon for how he ended up in France, you know, the cycle, the samsaric cycle goes back. There's all these karmic consequences of causes and effects, right? So I could understand it from that level. But from the spiritual being level or something, it made no sense. So I said, okay, and because of all these years of koan's practice and working myself with my teacher and with my students, I said, okay, well, I know what to do is, and a big part of it was working with Bernie Glassman, who plunged us into situations that didn't make sense. I said, okay, well, I'm going to go work at this, volunteer at this refugee center in Paris. It was this place where the refugees could come during the day. They could charge their phones, have a shower, have some coffee, whatever. They could apply for, they could be received and have their, be registered and then stay there for like between 5 and 10 days. There was facilities where they could sleep while they were waiting for their papers to be processed. And so I went and volunteered there and worked in the laundry room. So they would bring their laundry. These guys had, you know, surprisingly had not a lot of clothes, but they had clothes. They would bring their basket of laundry. We would wash it, dry it, fold it, and they would come back and get it like later in the day. So this experience was the way of like, okay, it makes no sense. I'm putting away all of my ideas about the situation, what I should do, what I shouldn't do, what I can do, what I can't do, what somebody else should do. I'm just going to go there and be there with them and see what it is. And what I could do was do their laundry and talk to them, you know, chat with these guys when they come up and talk, when they came up to give their laundry. Exchange, find out where they came from. They could ask where I came from. Basically, I had the experience that they were like my son. They were the same age as my son, basically, most of them, between like 20 and 30, most of them. Lots of them were very well educated, higher degrees, you know, university degrees. They were wearing the same clothes as my son. They had the same phones as my son, same backpack. But everything they owned was in that backpack. And their lifeline was that phone. You know? Listened to the same music. At one point, the directors of the center asked me to, they knew I did meditation, and they asked me if I would teach these guys meditation. So I said, okay. I didn't really know how, because there was nothing. There were only chairs like this. Some of them could speak English, some of them could speak French, but there wasn't really a common language, you know. I didn't speak Arabic, I didn't speak Farsi, I didn't speak, what's the language they speak in Afghanistan, I forget.
Pashtun.
What?
Pashtun.
Yeah, exactly, Pashtun. Some of the African languages I didn't speak, so. Okay, I said I would do it. So in the middle of this big, it was like an old warehouse that was open to the street and the highway outside and everything. We brought a circle of chairs and sat down, and mostly with signaling, you know, I showed them, you know, how to sit, told them to concentrate on their breath, to look down. There was a guy who spoke, there was one guy who spoke French and then some other language so he could translate. Another guy spoke English and some other languages, so we did minimal translation. And I, you know, signaled I had a little bell, and I said, I'll ring it, and whatever. So we did it for like 10 minutes. Then I showed them how to do walking meditation. We walked around the circle, walking meditation. Did it for another 10 minutes. And at the end, their faces were different than when we started. And some of them, you know, there was one guy who got up and walked away. There were other bystanders who were kind of looking, what are these people doing? You know, other people running around making noise. Didn't matter. One of the guys, his face was luminous, beaming, this guy. And he was one who spoke English or French, I forget. And he said, wow, we should do this more often. And I couldn't really guarantee that I would, because I didn't know how long they were. You know, the next group I did, it wasn't the same guys, because they were leaving. You know? It was only men. So I said, yeah, you can do this wherever you are. And this experience that you just had was home. I mean, this is kind of touchy thing to say to somebody who has left their home, right? And yet, from the spiritual being aspect, that was truth. He was home in that moment. And that's why it felt so good. And that's why he wanted to do it. That's why he said we should do this more often. And I wanted to give him a context so he could experience, to put on that experience. This is home. And wherever you are, in whatever circumstance, you can do this and come home. That this is your home. So all this to say that this was a koan for me, and yet I didn't solve anything. I didn't understand it in a different way, but I had the direct experience of what it was, as close as I could get to what it was to be a refugee and to be experiencing that, and to know them and not see them as other. Like I said, they were like my son. I knew who they were. You know, you could have these ideas. Oh, these are poor people. People think, oh, they're poor. They just want to come and exploit the Western economies, and they don't really have to leave home. But they do. They do. You know, there's a Bangladeshi guy in Paris, in Lisbon, who I met, who printed out something for me. He said, I had to leave. The political situation in Bangladesh is impossible. He came all by himself. He knows nobody. And yet, when we go towards, when we go into, instead of moving away and separating, then we have a different experience of life, of what it is to be here now. You know? And world conflicts, we see them differently. We experience it differently. So the little change, you know, I didn't change the refugee crisis, but I did make a difference in that guy's life. I'm sure. I'm sure that action, that 20 minutes of sitting, it made a difference in his life. Whether he ever did it again or not, I don't know. But it did make a difference. It made a difference in my life. Yeah. Definitely. How are we doing on time?
12:45.
Oh, so we're over time. Okay. Thank you very much. And if you're interested in, if you're from Coimbra and you want to come and sit and do this, here's your man. No, no. Thank you. And if you're in Aveiro, where you guys are, go there. Right? If that's where you are?
Yes.
Aveiro?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.